You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
It's Thursday morning.
By the way, just a beautiful day here in West Virginia. It was like 57 degrees or something when I got up this morning. It's going to be sunny and a beautiful day, probably in the low 70s, Bill.
Are you just cruelly twisting the knife in New Orleans and in New York City, every place ravaged by natural disaster? Like, hey, West Virginia, inland, away from extreme weather, it's all good here.
Well, no, we had major rains yesterday from Ida. And there was flash flood warnings in effect, and there's always the chance that the river could rise and all that. But here today, in the aftermath, it's amazing. It's beautiful. Fall-like, autumn-like.
This is sacrilegious for a New Englander to say, but I do feel the best foliage I have seen is in West Virginia. So I don't know when your season is, but I imagine it's coming up soon. If you're looking for a little socially distanced vacay, I would certainly recommend West Virginia in the fall.
Don't come here. No, it's bad. There's nothing to see. And it's just, yeah, no. Go to Massachusetts, people.
You're a West Virginia resident for what, 6 months? And now? Transplants, gentrifiers, get out.
Yeah, it's not worth seeing. You don't want to come here. No.
So we had breaking news this morning in Texas with the Supreme Court voting on a request for an emergency stay of Texas's new anti-abortion law, 5-4, saying let the law proceed and be implemented, claiming that they're not adjudicating the constitutionality of it, saying that it's such a novel, complex law, they need to wait before casting judgment on it. Of course, you could, it's a bit of an obtuse and maybe even disingenuous argument, because you could have a stay and then adjudicate the constitutionality of it down the road, but they chose not to do that. Is this, you know, is there singing in the land in the pro-life conservative part of the country today?
Well, I don't know about that. As I noted a while ago, I mean, I think that there's probably, I think the chances of the Supreme Court, you know, basically overturning Roe versus Wade are higher than people think. But I think there would be a backlash if that happens. And it's going to be just an incredibly difficult, intense fight over this, just what we needed, another culture war, you know, issue, right? As if, you know, well, Afghanistan and hurricanes aren't exactly culture war issues, but we got a lot going on. I'm not sure that people are like, bring it on, but you know, this is why this is why a lot of us got involved in politics. This is something a lot of people believe in. So I can just tell you my personal thought is, as someone who, I'm not the kind of person who like relishes fighting over hot button things, but I think this is coming to a head. This seems like it might be just like another data point on the way to something that's probably going to happen about a year from now.
Well, you know, I have a piece in the queue at the Washington Monthly. It's not up quite yet, and I had to, you know, tweak it, you know, after the news, the overnight news. There's two possible scenarios here, in my opinion. One is there are 5 Supreme Court justices that are absolutely prepared, to overturn or significantly gut Roe come June with the Mississippi 15-week abortion case. And this 5-4 vote on the stay is just an example of them laying their cards on the table. And if that is the case, then, you know, there's nothing anybody can do in the near term. They're just going to do it. There's no convincing them. I think there is another possible scenario. Of course, I can't be a mind reader, that there aren't 5 firmly committed to do it yet, even though there might be 5 inclined. They aren't all the way there. And allowing this Texas law to go forward is dipping the toe in the water. Let's see how this plays out, how chaotic it is, how controversial it is, how much backlash there is. Because, I mean, either you want to overturn Roe because you think it is, Roe is a constitutional abomination, and who cares about the politics? Who cares about the backlash? If it's wrong, it's wrong, and we're just going to overturn it. Or if you have some respect for precedent and some concern about the overall legitimacy of the court, you know, politics might enter into your thinking and say, look, if I overturn Roe v. Wade and the backlash is so severe that Democrats are going to be able to pack the court and fundamentally undermine legitimacy forevermore, maybe that's not worth it. And so let's see how Texas plays out before making that determination. So my counsel is to progressives, to those who are pro-choice, you know, you got to make noise now. You have to do everything possible to show how bad this will be. Other, if everyone goes into the attitude of shrugging your shoulders and say, yeah, you know, there's no stopping this freight train. Or I'm having some arguments with people on Twitter already that Democrats are just trying to pass a law in Congress, eliminate the filibuster and pass a law because the court's a hopeless cause. I think if you go down that path, you increase the odds the court will take that step. And I think that could lead to, a severe undermining of the court's legitimacy and a pillar of, you know, constitutional democracy.
Yeah. So this is probably not great salesmanship to promote what we do here, but I'm anxiously awaiting the advisory opinions podcast with Sarah Isger and David French, because their expertise is talking about the, you know, the legal nuances that you and I, Bill, I'll go there with the Afghanistan thing. Like, I'm not an expert on this. So I'm looking forward to hearing their take, to be honest with you, which should drop later today. Well, we're taping this on Thursday morning, right?
Yeah.
So I'll start with that. Two things. One, so I think there are 4 Supreme Court justices who have to agree to take up something.
To take a case. So the Mississippi case, there's a Mississippi case. It's a 15-week abortion ban. Back in May, the court decided to take that case, hear oral arguments in the coming term, which starts in October, likely ruling on that case late June, early July when the term ends. So only takes 4 to take the case. Doesn't tell you if there's 5 to concur with Mississippi.
So the assumption is that there were 4 conservatives who chose to take the case.
At minimum.
Which suggests, at least, right? Do we know? I don't know if we know how many actually voted, but I think the insinuation is that you would not vote to take on the case unless you were inclined to take the pro-life position on
the case. I mean, if the lower court already said the Mississippi law was unconstitutional, so the pro-choice thing is to say let it lie. We don't need to rule on this. This is already a clear decision by the lower court based on existing precedent. You only take the case if you want to overturn the precedent.
Yeah. One sort of caveat is that John Roberts in the past has what I believe he has made the wrong ruling. So, for example, on Obamacare, I believe that Roberts knew Obamacare was unconstitutional but reverse engineered a theory to uphold it because he thought the greater good of the legitimacy of the court and comity would be served by that decision. Now, I don't think that's the role of a judge to factor that in, but that was my take. And there's a chance maybe he would do that again. Now, the problem, though, is we have another we now have Amy Coney Barrett replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Right. And so even if John Roberts did not support the pro-life decision, you could still have a 5-4. Is that right, Bill?
Right. I mean, so I think, you know, Gorsuch, Alito, Thomas, you know, 99.99%. I mean, I think Thomas even said flat out Roe is wrong. Gorsuch wrote an opinion, we've lost our way on abortion. You know, and Coney Barrett, you know, maybe she's like 99.98 there. But I think there's a little bit more in her pre-Supreme Court writings, even though she's certainly someone who has written that there's that she's not tightly wedded to precedent, that she has some recognition of the importance of precedent. So yeah, maybe she would do a political thing here, but nothing in her rulings as justice have shown that flexibility on abortion, what limited opportunity she's had. Kavanaugh, there was a big profile of Kavanaugh by McKay Coppins in The Atlantic not too long ago, which, you know, painted more as an enigma. People have, you know, opposite views on where he would go on this. Seems a little disinclined to culture work. Kind of a Matt Lewis. You know, definitely pro-life, definitely anti-abortion, but really doesn't like the confrontation. And so when put in the hot seat here, you're not quite sure what he's going to do. Now, he voted with the majority in this on this Texas stay. And so the question then and Roberts didn't. Now, I think the Roberts reasoning.
And by the way, let me just say, everyone that I've heard who knows Kavanaugh is very confident that he will be pro-life. Mm-hmm. When, you know, that and the other point too, Bill, is, I mean, look, again, I need to, every time this issue comes up, I need to do like another, I'm not a lawyer, so I have to do like refresh my memory on stuff. But I mean, like, you know, Roe was based on kind of an invented notion of the right to privacy.
Well,
right, and as I recall,
in the conservative telling.
Well, there's no, I mean, it's not in the Constitution.
I mean, so you start Griswold v. Connecticut, which was about, you know, married couples and contraception. That was the first decision that said you take various parts of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and you put them together, and that creates a penumbra speaks to a right to privacy.
And as I recall, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and other progressives had publicly said that they're pro-abortion rights, but they think that Roe was like wrongly decided, or
you
that
know, Ginsburg articulated a different philosophical rationale for a right to abortion that was not Roe's rationale.
And then there's the Casey decision in 92,
yeah,
which established different things, including like viability. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my point is, even if you are, even if you're strongly philosophically pro-choice, the legal foundation that this all rests on is very shaky. That's why you have to talk about precedent, Bill. That's why precedent kind of becomes the thing, because the actual foundation is really shaky. Like, even if you're, even if you think that pro-choice is the right thing, you kind of have to concede that the foundation is not rock solid.
I mean, these are subjective terms. I mean, I could say that DC versus Heller is shaky because it's only been a few years old and it's not, and there wasn't a whole lot of constitutional Supreme Court opinions along those lines in the 200 years prior.
But there is a Second Amendment. I mean, there is a right to bear arms. There is not.
It's a very convolutedly worded amendment that people interpret differently.
I think the Second Amendment
is a shaky amendment because it's so poorly worded.
I agree. Look, what is a well-armed militia? Okay. But at least there is a right to bear arms. It's the Second Amendment. There is no right to an abortion in the Constitution. And so, you know.
Well, before we go too deep down, you know, the broader constitutional debate here, let's get back to what these justices are potentially thinking. You know, Roberts's argument, his dissent in this Texas stay, he said, the state legislature imposed, quote, a prohibition on abortions after roughly 6 weeks, then, quote, essentially delegated enforcement of that prohibition to the populace at large. So as people might now know, the way the Texas law is structured, it doesn't give public officials any enforcement authority. It deputizes any citizen to sue any abortion provider, anyone helping someone getting an abortion. So even like a cab driver driving you to the clinic, an insurance company paying the insurance claim. So you can sue from anywhere in the country. And if you win, you get 10 grand and your legal costs covered. And if the defendants win, they get nothing. So it's heavily skewed towards encouraging people to sue abortion providers.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing, right? I mean, traditionally conservatives have not been the litigious side, right?
Well, in the Trumpian party, that view might have shifted. But you know, I think Roberts has a pretty long-standing animosity towards getting cute with the law. I think he doesn't like these clever plays that they feel sort of manifestly disingenuous. And so, like when Trump did some cute stuff, he was like, "Look, kid, you know, let's be commonsensical here." You know, here in Texas, he seems like, "Look, you guys didn't have the moxie to actually own responsibility for your own law." That doesn't fly with me, which is sort of separate from, you know, is Roe v. Wade, you know, accurately decided or not. So that just sort of says to me, he's not inclined to uphold this law when it's fully reviewed. And so my question to you is, Matt, are there any conservatives outside of John Roberts saying, look, I want to get rid of Roe, I want to get rid of Casey, but this whole sue everybody thing, you know, that kind of violates my innate conservativeness. Is there anybody out there like that?
I haven't heard yet. I mean, I think it's too soon to say. You know, like I was just listening to, you know, a podcast with, is it David Jolly and Charlie Sykes at The Bulwark? And they were sort of saying some of those things, or at least implying it. maybe not that was a deal breaker for them, but that it raised questions, you know, about if this is kind of the right thing to do. But, you know, I think you've got two things going on here. I think you've got the Trump era, which is about owning the libs, and the ends justify the means. And then I think you've got the fact that this issue is, again, the reason that like so many of us got involved in politics. And it's just such a defining issue for a pro-life movement that predates Donald Trump by a long time. And so I don't suspect you're going to have a lot of people who are a lot of conservatives who are pro-life, strongly pro-life, who are quibbling over the way that they're going about this, is my guess.
I find the approach strange. I mean, because look, you got a 6-3 court. You got a court pretty predisposed to the anti-abortion, anti-Roe way of thinking. And it seems like at the state level, there's a lack of patience
Yeah.
So you already have this Mississippi case in the queue. They've already taken the case. It's a pretty audacious case to go to 15 weeks. I mean, it's directly in defiance of Casey. It's in defiance of the viability standard. And if you win that case, that's moving the ball way down the field. And instead of sort of letting that, let's just see what happens there. You now have Texas and other states pushing these fetal heartbeat bans, which are roughly a 6-week ban. And so you're at a point where, I mean, many people don't even know they are pregnant, at that point. Cause it's not even 6 weeks after conception. It's six weeks after, you know, your last, period. And now you have Texas's law being put in place before, I mean, Mississippi's law is not in place. And so the court could rule on Mississippi in sort of a could have in a calmer space. But now they're going to make that ruling after Texas is in effect for nearly a year. I mean, I think it could, when there's a risk from the pro-life perspective, risk that's going to make the Supreme Court flinch and not do what they want in Mississippi. And two, you know, if they go forward on that, the backlash on the left is already cranking up and could well make it hard for Republicans to win the midterms if you have an animated Democratic base.
I wrote a Daily Beast piece when the Mississippi thing came down, making the point that, like, that, you know, no one is talking about the potential for a Supreme Court decision on abortion, which would happen theoretically right before the midterms.
Right. This is June or July 2022, you know, literally 4 months before the midterm.
And so, you know, nobody, I haven't heard anybody else factor in this issue as a potential for changing the trajectory, which everybody assumes that Republicans are easily going to take, certainly the House. Bill, I guess it's just this goes back to kind of an age-old question about activism, which is it prudent to stake out a very defensible position that is really hard to argue with on pro-life, or is the Overton window better? Like, is it better for these states to really try to push the Overton window, farther to the right? Like, which of those two options is going to result in more pro-life policies?
I mean, I would think, I mean, because clearly the objective for the pro-life movement is not to end up at some sort of middle ground. They want to get rid of abortion, period. They want to convince people. It requires a degree of persuasion, which I think they are not so keen on doing that spade work on. They just want to get it and push through whatever they can push through whenever they can. Hold on one second, Matt. I'm getting a poor connection message on my Skype now that it went away.
I mean, as you know, Bill, I think my just sort of temperamentally and strategically, my instinct would be to stake out a, you know, very defensible position on this. And so, for example, we could talk about how even in liberal Europe, they've got like a 20-week ban. You know, and surely that's something that, like, I think is, you know, ought to be like a mainstream popular thing to do.
Well, is that of these 20-week bans that are flat, or 20-week bans with medical exceptions?
Personally, I have always been in favor of exceptions. But there are pro-life people we've talked about this before, probably years ago. There are problems with allowing for exceptions. One problem is that all you need is a doctor to say the life of the mother is at stake. And, like, what does that really mean? How do you how do you quantify that or prove that? Another problem is that if you allow for exceptions on, let's say, rape, a rape exception, for example, it undermines the argument that every life is precious, the dignity of the unborn child, that, so there are legitimate reasons, or at least, serious reasons why people don't want to allow exceptions. But I've always felt like politics, this is an area where I would sort of divorce maybe like my own preference from politics, which is to say that I think politics is a very messy business by definition, and carving out public policy is not perfect. And so I would allow exceptions because I think that it if you're going to get a broad consensus that that it gets us there and that it would save lives and it'd be certainly a big incremental gain. But see, that's my bias toward comity and persuasion. But there are probably, I'm sure, plenty of people who are pro-lifers who are saying, no, this is our moment. And in a negotiation, you ask for more than you think you're going to get, right? So if we ask for something that sounds reasonable, we're going to get less because that's how negotiations go. So let's ask for a lot.
I think if persuasion's the name of the game, this Texas plan to sue everybody is not the way to go. I mean, this is so ripe for nasty, frivolous, punitive, harassing lawsuits. I mean, because there's no adult supervision on it. I mean, you could sue anybody. And there's no downside for the plaintiff in this. So it just seems like a way to really alienate the middle. And mind you, I mean, we look at Texas as this big conservative state. It's a big blueing state. I mean, it's not blueing as fast as Democrats would like, but there's a lot of population influx. It's a lot of college educated people coming in, and college educated people, surveys show, are more pro-choice than non-college educated. So,
depending on how you frame it. I mean, I think there's a way to frame it. When you start asking questions a different way, people become more pro-life.
Yeah. I mean, depending, obviously numbers can change depending on the framing, but it just as a general matter, the people coming into Texas are more inclined to abortion rights than the people who were there previously. Wow. And so you're now instigating a culture war battle royale on turf, which I think for conservatives is a little shaky. Well, this is the kind of thing that would accelerate the bluing trend.
I mean, I'll just use myself as a microcosm for them. I was very comfortable talking about Afghanistan because I know I would have talked about Afghanistan. Okay. But because I'm somebody who is traditionally not gone on, like, say, Fox News to preach to the choir, but I've gone on, like, CNN or MSNBC and kind of gone into the lion's den and tried to argue conservative positions that I could defend. You know, these things like what you're bringing up in Texas, it's very easy for the other side to say, like, you don't even think that women who've been, raped, or that they should even, it's very easy for the other side to attack the pro-life cause when you have something like this come down. And again, like, politics involves fighting and fighting over ideas, and that's just the name of the business. It's not for sissies. Is that politically incorrect? I don't know. It's not for wimps. Also, maybe politically incorrect. Politics ain't beanbag. It ain't beanbag. And it is about fighting to a certain degree. But then the question is, like, what turf do you want to be fighting on? Like, do you want the high ground? You know, do you want? And so, there are ways to go into a mainstream media environment where most people do not share my values, there are ways to go in and try to make a compelling argument. And some of the things happening right now make that a harder thing to do, I would say.
Why don't we shift gears to Afghanistan? Biden gave his speech this week, pretty defiant speech. You've not been the biggest imperialist in the world. You don't want to fight endless wars everywhere, but you're very critical of Biden's handling of Afghanistan. Do you think he has recovered it all politically by being unrelenting, staking out his turf, sticking to it, and defending it?
I think he's completely botched everything to do with it. I was against the withdrawal, but let's get past that. The execution of the withdrawal was horrible. He lied to us about so many things. And then even his speech, where he talks about the buck stops here, but he also blames, the Afghanistan government, blames Trump, blames, the Afghan security forces. It's not the leadership that we were hoping that Biden would get. And I have to say, whether it's the abortion issue, where the left, if they follow your advice, Bill, and I think they will, the left is going to scream bloody murder right now. Whether it's that issue or whether it's Biden's handling of Afghanistan, it made me really happy that I did not vote for Biden in the 2020 in November. And I think there's a problem for Biden, which is, according to that big Pew survey from a while back, Biden won because he got, some never Trumpers to win. I don't know if you saw the Ron Johnson comments. Did you see that hidden Ron Johnson video that came out?
I didn't.
So there's a hidden video of Ron Johnson basically explaining to a constituent that actually Donald Trump did lose the election. And he's making the point that Trump would have won Wisconsin, but there were a whole bunch of people. There were like tens of thousands of people who voted for other Republicans in Wisconsin, but did not vote for Trump. And Ron Johnson is explaining to this voter or this constituent, actually Trump lost. And if Trump had just gotten the votes that other Republicans got in the state, he would have won. So, there is a never Trump vote out there. They undervoted Trump in Wisconsin. And some of those people helped elect Joe Biden. And Joe Biden is going out of his way to alienate people like that, at least if I'm any bellwether of it. It's like, I mean, the last month. And Bill Kristol, who, as you know, has been a big Biden supporter, basically came out the other day and said that, he knows a lot of people who voted for Biden who won't vote for him again now.
Well, governing is hard, and it's easier to stitch together a disparate coalition when you're the opposition party, when you have to govern and make decisions and make compromises, have trade-offs, make hard calls, have some calls not work out well. All these things weaken a coalition. This is why presidents' parties usually lose midterms, because governing coalitions weaken. I think it would not be surprising at all if some of these votes do peel off.
Yeah.
And it is a bad midterm for Democrats for that reason.
If you're Biden, say, it is very clear the reason I won the election, according to the data, is that people like Matt Lewis, even though I didn't vote for Biden.
So purely Bill Kristol.
Basically, it was, if I'm remembering that Pew survey or whatever, it was like Biden didn't win the presidency by juicing the Obama coalition or turning out, you know, minority groups or women or whatever you might think a Democrat would need to do to win. Like, that's not why he won. He won because he lost people, say, like married white men by a smaller percentage than most Democrats typically do. If you knew that, like if you knew that that was the reason you won the presidency, wouldn't you go out of your way to like make special overtures to keep that group, that coalition?
I mean, it's a very, 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 very fine line Biden has to walk here to try to keep the base satisfied and to keep his hold on the swing. And when you have to make decision after decision after decision, and again, it's not, and you know, we said this before, you know, you can criticize Biden for making this Afghanistan decision. You can say we didn't have to make it. It could have just held back, but not deciding is deciding. Afghanistan wasn't static. And so staying in is a choice too. There's no way to just not be involved. Like, you're in it. You're in all sorts of things when you're president. So it's just impossible to.
Okay. But let me ask you this then. We have 900 troops in Syria. Did Biden make a choice to be in Syria? Is Biden?
He's made a choice by not pulling out. And
is that a big deal though? Does anybody?
Not today. But if things flared up, and if 10 of those people got killed tomorrow, then it would be a big deal. You know, I just don't know what the next day is going to bring. These are the things that presidents have to weigh.
You get my point, which is, like, I do think it was a solution in need of a problem in so many ways. Like, even if he had just postponed it for a year, let's just say, I'm not saying that would have fixed anything, but I don't know that this was like the top, like the first thing, the burner or whatever, like the most important thing that he needed. Like, so, okay. We're 7 months in, and now Joe Biden has given us the Taliban, ISIS-K, and Al-Qaeda back. Good job. 7 months in.
Well, I mean,
got those groups back.
Understand you're giving a very, very pat and perhaps spun narrative there. But I grant you that could well be the narrative in 2022. My point is the other's timeline may have been Taliban offensive storming Afghanistan and American troops being killed. And you promised to get out. What are you waiting for? I mean, there's just no perfect answer to it, to your tragical problems when you're president. I can't say definitively whether this is the least worst decision that you could have made.
Right. But today, you know, I have to go thoroughly read the story, but there's like a big piece in the Washington Post about, you know, Biden attacking this Texas bill, Texas, the Supreme Court's.
Yeah.
You get it. He's talking about, you know, the constitutional right for an abortion or something to that effect. Is that what Biden should be doing if he's thinking about me being the difference between him being in the White House or not? Like, is that he doesn't seem like somebody who appreciates how he got elected president.
Well, he was always. And the party has been forthrightly pro-choice for a long time. He, in whatever pro-life elements in Biden's record have existed, Biden clearly recalibrated that, got himself more square with the mainstream of the Democratic Party for the general election. You know, he didn't win with a lot of, you know, anti-abortion votes. I think there's always some diversity in anybody's coalition. But anyone who voted for Joe Biden knew full well what they're voting for in that regard. And so I don't think Biden's taking as big of a risk on that score. Afghanistan is different because I think there are those foreign policy hawkish never Trumpers. I mean, they may not be a huge part of the Biden coalition, but they're non-zero. And yeah. those folks are now displeased. Abortion, I don't think he's taking as big of a risk there, especially because the Republicans are taking an extreme position in what's going on with Texas.
With the Afghanistan thing, you were looking for things like competence and kindness. He got into like an argument apparently with a or bristled at a Gold Star family.
Let's be careful how we characterize these things. I mean, I read the story, but we heard the story from, and actually the story itself didn't really say to me that Biden was being angry or rude, but they were people understandably angry that their children have been killed. And
no, the story did suggest that he was being rude, that that he wanted to talk about his own son instead of.
But that's what Biden has always done, has always talked about Beau as a way to show, you know, sympathy and empathy.
Phil, you and I know if somebody has a loss, you know, if your dad just died, I wouldn't come to you and be like, you know, I know exactly how you feel, ma'am. I lost my dad. My dad in 2004. It really hit me. You know, like, that's not how you.
People do that.
It's the exact thing you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to do that.
There are lots of that do that. Maybe it doesn't work for everybody. Maybe some people don't appreciate it, that you're making it about yourself. But it's not unusual. And Beau was a veteran
about this with Trump, and I don't think, you know, I'm holding Biden to basically the same standard. But my point, though, is without getting into the weeds on this one incident, people thought that Biden would bring competence. That's undermined by Afghanistan. They thought he would bring, you know, honesty. They lied to us so much throughout this, documented, you know, multiple times. And they thought that he would bring a sort of a kindness and a decency and an affability. He's angry. Biden is now angry. If you watch those speeches, he's mad. He's mad.
I wouldn't say mad. I would say defiant. I think he is trying to show that he's unwavering, that he's not second-guessing himself. And I mean, you know, one person's mad is another person's strength. There are some people out there saying, hell yeah, we should get the hell out of there. Thank God Joe Biden stuck to it and isn't listening to all these naysayers. And we don't know how Afghanistan's going to look 1 month, 2 months, 3 months from now. If that's not top of mind, plenty of people are going to say, hey, we got our soldiers back. Great. Let's move on to the next thing. And Biden didn't do anything to undermine the position that he took.
You know, this is static and news cycles move on sometimes. But he is down, right? His fave unfaves.
Oh, he's definitely down. I mean, there was some analysis before the airport bombing to suggest that was being driven more by COVID and the Delta variant spike than it was by Afghanistan. I think it's a little hard to separate these things, but they're both happening at the same time. And to your point, Matt, to the extent that Biden is being charged with incompetence in Afghanistan, I think that spills over to everything else. If Biden is no longer seen as a competent administration, then it's hard to argue that, hey, he's doing all he could on COVID, and this Delta variant is the fault of unvaccinated Trumpers, not because Biden's not doing his due diligence.
I agree with that. I think the one that's even more, the spillover is even worse, is the honesty thing. I mean, it was so clear that he lied to us about so many things in Afghanistan that it makes me wonder, like, can I trust anything else that they're telling us? You know what I mean? That to me is the greater danger, that we start to lose faith in the veracity. And by the way, he was supposed to be the opposite of Trump, you know, and so this undercuts that.
I don't think Trump. I mean, every president spins. Every president gives a favorable depiction of the decisions that they took. That is hardly unusual. Trump is a whole other, you know, strata of mendacity that Biden is nowhere close to. If you're going to say, well, Biden said this about when the Kabul might fall, and now he's saying that this was to be expected. Like, I'm not saying that's great, but that's pretty standard presidential spinning, not Trump level.
He also said, we're not going to leave any Americans behind. And they did. There's a lot of stuff.
There's no soldier left behind.
Okay.
Usually that line is about soldiers. And the question is now, are there people behind who are dual citizens, people who were Afghan interpreters for us, that we couldn't get all of them out? I'm not saying it's good. Anyone who wants to get out has not gotten out. It's obviously not good. And you certainly can charge Biden with being, it's like an Obama. If you want to keep your plan, you know, you can keep your plan. Well, that didn't mention that some people might change their plans. I mean,
if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor.
Right. I mean, this is more typical presidential spinning than outright lying.
I think you're being too. I will agree with you that Trump is qualitatively and quantitatively, but certainly qualitatively different. But I think it is wrong for you to write off what Obama said and what Biden said and just hand wave it away as, well, they all do that. I think that's part of the way you get Trump.
Well,
I don't think we should tolerate or accept. I mean, that was, you know, Obama doesn't get pinged for this as much by the mainstream media, I think, because of liberal bias. But that has to be one of the greatest broken promises in political history.
I mean, I wouldn't say that. I think that is far. I think that's far too hysterical a charge. Having said that, it hurt him. It unquestionably hurt him. I mean, I think PolitiFact said it was like the lie of the year, whatever it was. So it's not like he got away with it. They got reelected, but it clearly hurt him in the midterms. And Biden might well be hurt by this, particularly if one of these people dies. So I'm not trying to suggest that that it's small beer politically. But I do bristle at this as, oh, this is, I thought we weren't getting Trump. This is just like Trump. This is not just like Trump. It may be a problem for Biden and maybe worthy of criticism, but it's not Trump.
Well, I agree that it's not that qualitatively Trump is worse, but Biden's raison d'etre is being the opposite of Trump. And that implies a lot of things. And I feel like Biden has not lived up to that promise of being that stark contrast to Trump that we hoped he would be.
I don't think there's a lot of people there saying this is just like Trump. Everything that's happened in the past 8 months, it's like Trump never left.
I don't think people are saying that. I think what they're saying is frustration that, like, no matter who we elect, we can't find someone who's going to solve our problems. We're just jumping from from one corrupt, you know, administration to another incompetent one.
This was the Jimmy Carter problem. This was the Bill Clinton problem. This was the Barack Obama problem. This is a Democratic problem because Democrats are held to higher standards than Republicans on a lot of these fronts because they sell themselves as being, you know, morally clean, more honest, more compassionate, more interested in the common person, the common good, and perfection is impossible. Mistakes happen, trade-offs happen, presidents spin. You're caught in difficult situations, and it's hard to be 100% forthright without undercutting yourself. And so you get dinged on these things. So that's,
I agree. I completely agree that we live in a fallen world, and politics is messy, and bad stuff's gonna happen. Like, you're gonna have to deal with problems. It just seems like Biden has really created a lot of them. I mean, it doesn't feel like a return to normalcy. It doesn't feel like, okay, finally, some time to not, you know, like that promise of like, okay, now you can exhale, he has not lived up to that. And like Afghanistan is a debacle of his choosing, like in so many ways. And that's kind of not what I was hoping for, to be honest, you know?
Well,
after Trump, after the chaos of Trump, I will say this. I thank Biden that his speeches are always midday, because Trump would have done like a 9 o'clock speech, PM speech, like a prime time thing, which would have impacted me personally. I don't like that. So thank you, Biden, for wanting to go to bed early and doing the. No, I will say Biden's always hour and a half late to everything he does. But at least he's doing it in the afternoon. So I appreciate that.
Oh, we probably should wrap. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we jump?
I hope that I'm not. Do I seem bitter? Maybe I drank too much coffee.
I mean, I don't know. You didn't vote for the guy. What do you have to be bitter about?
I don't want to be like.
You weren't betrayed. You didn't vote for him.
Like, I don't want to become the curmudgeon that Biden is slowly becoming. I don't go from like nice, affable Biden to, you know, over caffeinated. But okay. Usually a lot of times we do this and I feel like you talk me down, and that just didn't happen.
I'm not sure what I can do on the score today. Your mood is not intrinsically linked with Biden's approval rating.
Maybe the madometer is a thing, Bill.
I think it's possible Biden recovers from this. I mean, you know, I mean, every president has dips. Every president has bad moments in their trajectories. And to have to hit a rough patch politically, you know, late in the first year, early second year, hardly unusual. Biden does need to be better, way better than average for Democrats to avoid a midterm loss. I mean, and even a better than average midterm for Democrats would mean loss of both chambers of Congress. So they got to be particularly good to avoid that problem. And so looking at things today, it feels a lot more like a normal presidential trajectory. Mistakes happen, coalitions fray, hovering around 50%, a little bit under it right now. That's not going to be good enough. He needs a pretty big turnaround.
It's feeling more like a one-term. It's premature, Bill, but it's feeling more like a one-term president to me.
Argument is this is not indicative of a one-term president. Plenty of two-term presidents have moments like this. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Reagan and Lebanon, for Pete's sake. Reagan already went through a horrible recession in 82 and had the Lebanon debacle in 83, a humiliating pullout in spring of 84, wins with a massive landslide. Bill Clinton had a horrible first year.
Biden's no Ronald Reagan either, though. I'll tell you that.
You don't know that yet. I mean, Reagan didn't look so much like Reagan in 1982.
Laying the groundwork with the Fed for the economic comeback, it seems to me like the opposite groundwork has been laid. Maybe I'll be proven wrong, but it seems more likely to me that things. But again, hey, look, your point is we see through a glass darkly, and you might have in 1982, you wouldn't have predicted 49 states, right? In 1984.
Not 82. Certainly not. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton had, you know, he had a failed stimulus, BTU tax, had the controversial tax hike, had the gays in the military, don't ask, don't tell debacle. You know, he was trending down, in that first year, and a terrible 94 midterm. Barack Obama hit the skids by March 2010. The economy had not recovered despite the stimulus. The beer summer was a mess. And he signed Obamacare on the dip. You know, it was not a victory lap moment for him. And also terrible midterm. Yeah. Still recovered.
I can't quantify this. It's undocumented. There's no way to prove it. But it felt like Bill Clinton had energy and the zeitgeist was with him in a lot of ways. And the same thing with Obama, like excitement, energy. Like
after the 94,
Biden feels like Jimmy Carter.
After the 94 midterm, people were saying, is the presidency still relevant? And Bill had to come out and say, the president is still relevant. It was humiliating. He seems small, but the economy turned around in time. So I would not extrapolate out to 2024 from this. I do think it makes for a very narrow window to turn things around for 2022. Cause you need two things to happen. You need your party unified and the other party disunified. Now, the other party that's unified, that might still happen. I don't think the Republicans are super lockstep right now. But you're definitely seeing Democrats more willing to criticize Biden on both the left and the right, be impatient, demand this, demand that. That dynamic, that might be harder to put that toothpaste back in the tube for 2022. I think a lot of things have to go right if that's going to happen.
All right. I feel a little better now. Okay. Your work is done.
Because Republicans will do better in the midterms.
No, I don't know. It was just, I just need a little more Bill Scherer. I don't know.
All right. So we're not going to DM Zoom tomorrow. I might do a Zoom myself, if you don't mind.
Cool. Okay.
I'll do solo Zoom. So be if you're on my Patreon supporter list, I'll send out an announcement with the details. Otherwise, we'll talk next week.
We'll talk next week. See you then.
Anything to plug?
Let's see. Well, I talked to Dan Darling, who was the fired by the National Religious Broadcasters for his pro-vaccine stance. We had a really good podcast. And I'm supposed to talk to David French on Friday. We'll see, knock on wood, but hopefully we'll have a good conversation too. How about you, Bill?
I check out my stuff at the monthly. Say hi, Laz. I got my Texas piece is up. I got a piece about Jerome Powell and whether he should be renominated at the Fed. That's also up at the monthly. Otherwise, I'll talk to you next week.
All right. See y'all later.
Bye-bye. Thanks.